Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, before we get the show started, I wanted to let you know we're giving away a bunch of brand new Black Magic gear.
Yeah, cameras, switchers, DaVinci Resolve licenses, a bunch of awesome stuff. So stay tuned to learn how you can enter to win free gear from Black Magic, and we're going to tell you all about it later on in this episode. Now cue the music.
Hey, welcome to the 152nd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode was brought to you by patrons Charles Coleman and Kevin O'Brien. I'm Matt Enlow.
And I'm Oren Kaplan, and on this episode we have Carrie Gilogley. She is a creative development exec.
Yeah, she's a VEEP. She's a VP of development over at AMC.
The network that brought you such amazing shows as Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
And a whole bunch of other great ones. I've known Carrie for a long time. We're pals from college. And so we get to talk a lot about the nature of development. We haven't really gotten into the day-to-day of what they actually do, and more specifically and importantly and pertinently to you, listener, what they're looking for and how they find the people that they love working with.
Yeah, we dive into both how they find writers and new shows and also how they find directors for pilots and for series. But just before we get into that conversation, real quick, I think we should just define what a development person does. Her job is to find shows, get them on the air, and also to continue with existing shows.
Yeah, right? Shepherding them through kind of the whole process. You know, like they're working with the showrunner, the creators, the writers. You know, they're not necessarily in the trenches, but they are the liaison between the rest of the TV side of the whole equation.
They're the people that get shows made.
Yeah, advocate for shows. And the thing that I love the most about Carrie is that more than maybe any other executive I know, Carrie loves writers. She loves working with writers. She loves finding them and empowering them. And that has always been her dream. And she's living it. I've known Carrie since we were teenagers. And she's like day one, she was like, I'm going to be a producer. So here we are.
Cool. What did you say?
I said, I'm going to be a podcaster.
You're like, I'm going to a frat party.
I did not go to a frat party. Jeez Louise.
I'm trying to paint a picture of you that's totally fake on this episode.
Yeah.
Just because you're with a college friend. I think we'll skip our catch up, even though I have some great things to talk about.
Ooh, I can't wait to talk to you about it next week.
But before we talk to Carrie, I want to remind people about our Patreon. It's actually been going pretty well.
Super great. Yeah, we've seen a lot of steady growth. It's the thing that helps us pay Jay, our editor, and keep our live shows alive and happening. We've been making a lot of small adjustments to the show. Like, we're doing more remote episodes. We're investing in the gear a little bit more. So that's all thanks to the help and support of you, the listeners, providing us with a little bit of patronage. So, you know, if you think it's worthwhile to throw us a buck or two once a month, Patreon is a great way to show your support. And honestly, most of it goes directly to Jay. So,
yeah. And we are going to have another live event very soon.
Very soon. I would love to go to a few film festivals.
Oh, yeah.
Right? Like other places where people who listen to the show can meet with other listeners, basically.
Hey, how about this? If you are involved in a film festival and you have a cool panel on directing and you think we should be there, let us know. Our email is justshootitpod@gmail.com.
Yeah. Without further ado, let's talk to Carrie Gilogley from AMC.
All right.
Carrie Gilogley.
Yeah.
On Gilogley. The mic.
Woo!
So you work in development.
I do.
You're our first development guest.
Carrie, you're kicking off Development Month.
You're initiating it.
You are at AMC.
Yes.
You've been there for kind of a while now, right?
Almost 7 years.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow, that's wild.
It'll be 7 years in July.
So when you started, Breaking Bad was still going. It was kind of like the dawn
Mad Men.
New AMC, basically. Yeah, yeah, Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
Yeah, no, well, Breaking Bad was like ending. It probably had Walking Dead. Breaking Bad had two seasons left. Mad Men had like 1.5 seasons left. Mad Men had two seasons left.
Right.
But
right.
So it was like, you know, a good run in the midst of a good run.
Sure. And so that's a great time to, I remember when you got that job, it was like, oh, it's a very cool place to work. People are very excited about it and everyone is looking for what the next thing is, basically.
Yeah. I mean, I think television is, I mean, this was me switching from features to television to work at AMC. Yeah. And I think that TV is interesting because you, in a lot of ways, are looking for something that's unique. Whereas like a lot of, on the feature side, you're looking for something with pre-awareness that's mm-hmm. sort of familiar. Mm-hmm. And that's less true now than it was many years ago. In my time in the television business, has basically become features mm-hmm. in a lot of ways. So,
do you mean in that they also require pre-awareness?
In some cases, I mean, I think a brand is meaningful. I think movie stars are meaningful. I think a big idea is meaningful in a way that used to not be the case as much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not religion. You know,
sure.
It doesn't have to be that way, but it is happening more and more because of the sort of arms race that's...
Everything.
Yeah,
that's entertainment.
Like... Yeah. Just like to get as many eyeballs and make as many things as you can.
I'm going to pump the brakes immediately. Like
great.
Really early on. You said the term big idea. People hear big idea all the time. What do you mean by big idea?
I mean, I think a big idea, it can mean a lot of different things. I think that what I meant it in a bit of a pejorative way when I was just saying it, but that it doesn't have to be. I mean, I think that like high concept mm-hmm. is maybe like, I think that a hook, like mm-hmm. something that feels like, I think a big idea could mean to somebody a big concept, like it's an operatic space battle, you know, different worlds against each other and all mm-hmm. that. Or it could mean a big idea through like a keyhole perspective, like something like Signs mm-hmm. or maybe a big idea that's lo-fi, like Primer that, Shane Carruth.
Sure. Carruth.
But so when you say lo-fi, you mean that it's the execution is kind of lo-fi.
Yeah, well, I mean, the budget was super low and the concept, it's time travel, but it's guys that literally to time travel, they're like in a garage, like locked away for 4 hours and then they wake up and it's a week ago.
Right. But so is like Ex Machina or Machina, however you pronounce it, is that...
Big idea?
Because to me, that's like almost like a small idea executed in a hi-fi way.
People use that term to mean a lot of different things.
Right.
I think it could also just mean like you hear it and you just have never heard anything like it before. It feels mm-hmm. like Groundhog Day is a big idea in some ways.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, like because that's like a...
But that they totally ripped off Happy Death Day, if you've seen that movie.
Oh, yeah. Mm. That's right.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the original.
The original.
I mean, Bill Murray saw it and he was like, get me my time machine back to 1991.
Well, such he called Shane Carruth.
Yeah.
It was just in turnaround.
He sat in a refrigerator box for 3 years. Then came out in 1991.
I am realizing that development is its own ecosystem in a lot of ways, in that you talk about story and filmmaking in general nonstop all day, right?
Mm-hmm.
But in kind of an insular situation where you end up with a lot of jargon, I guess is what I'm saying. Do you know what I mean? So like I can remember times where I've been in meetings, having been in development, and been like, big idea... I think I know what you mean by that, but like, who knows? The big idea is probably a more transparent term than I'm thinking of, but like you said keyhole earlier.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Things like that. Like, so I feel like a lot of the show,
people talk about scope.
Scope, noisy. There's just, stuff, right?
I feel
right?
Like, so. I mean, it might not be as popular now, but I feel like people used to always ask like what the engine was
mm-hmm.
yeah.
for like a series.
That's
still a common
more word. People should ask that about the shows that they make.
Ooh.
I'll say that.
A little burn there, a little shade.
Oh yeah. Shade on everybody.
Can I tell you, I was trying to find the name of the person we pitched to, but I pitched this show a couple of years ago. We pitched to this company. The woman whose company it was allegedly at AMC, and she's the one that like found Breaking Bad and Mad Men. I forget her name.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I was like trying to find. But when we pitched our show, which was kind of this like sci-fi mystery thriller show. It's like a very similar show to Manifest that's on TV right now.
Yeah.
And I mean, there was like 100 shows that came out that, like, when we were pitching it, those were kind of like exactly our show. But the feedback that we got from the development person there that we pitched to was that there's like, that our show felt like a network show because there were like all these characters and all these storylines, and they think of a cable show as one that really focuses on like one character in the pilot and slowly unfolds into like the world, not the world, but that the rest of the characters kind of come off of like one person's point of view, as opposed to like showing you like multiple points of view right in the beginning, which I thought was like an interesting,
that's pretty accurate,
an interesting way to think about cable versus network.
Well, I think it's, again, it's less true now, the because I think the more streaming services that there are out there, and sort of like the less form focused development is, because it's like you get shows that are, they just happen to be episodic, and they have, but their concept is so big, they don't need to follow any rules. And I think that it's a whole, you know, a whole other podcast we could have about whether or not they should follow some rules. Mm-hmm. And is it really working when you know, that they, you know, when they don't follow certain conventions, sure, of long form series writing.
Right. You're saying basically that the difference between traditional television, something that comes out weekly versus something that's intended to binge, and then also doesn't have to worry about the constraints of broadcast being like a certain runtime, things like that, all of a sudden that changes the storytelling as well.
Part of it is that, I mean, but I think something like Ozark or whatever, that could easily be on any cable network. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be on Netflix. And that is a more of a traditional television, sure, story. It can go on for a long time. It is one single character. It starts with him and it kind of opens up. And that is more of a, I think that's definitely something that AMC does or covets in some whatever way. Like, they look for that. Again, back to like streaming services, and there's maybe more of a value put on high concept. I think that those rules don't apply as much to everyone anymore. That said, if you brought me a thing with multiple leads, the reason why people shy away from that is that a lot of times when you have a lot of different leads, you only have a really limited amount of time with each of them. Mm-hmm. So inevitably, when you tell the story of the character, each character, it's reduced to
like five scenes.
Yeah, or like a simple archetype. Mm-hmm. And so you don't really get to know anybody. So you don't really connect with anybody. And it could not be as sophisticated or deep as it could be.
Or
if
compelling.
Compelling.
Less good, really.
Yeah, if you're only going to focus on one character. So if you took all that real estate and you just dedicated to one guy or one girl, then all of a sudden you know somebody in this way that you couldn't if you were doing like five different characters that all had their own story. And I think to your point, as far as like runtime is concerned, that's a big factor if you have to obey like an hour long format.
Right. I guess what I'm saying, like if I'm a listener now and I'm like interested in coming, you know, I have a great idea for a TV show and I want to pitch it and stuff. Like if I look at a show like Maniac and say like, oh, well, my show's just like Maniac and they made Maniac, so they'll probably be interested in my show. Yeah. It's like those shows that break the format, and that like the Romanoffs are like kind of these shows that have these oddball like runtimes or like arcs or whatever, like they're being made by prestige showrunners.
Sure.
They're not like someone's
first thing.
Like the litmus test on that show on whether you're going to green light it or not is not the format. It's, sure, the filmmakers.
Well, I think that's a very good point that any new person should keep in mind, that if they're comparing their show to something that maybe has like a lot of A+ talent in it, I think that, you know, that their material needs to stand on its own because nobody knows who they are yet, you know?
Right. Just to go back to the engine thing, I think we have a lot of listeners that like work in Hollywood, but I think there's some that a lot of stuff is new to them. So I think something I just thought of is like, to me, the engine of the show is kind of like what pushes us from episode to episode, right? It's like what's generating the cliffhangers and the seasonal arc, and like why we want to kind of tune back in next week, I guess, in the traditional, right? And I do think maybe like, this is just an observation that's probably totally wrong, but I'm just going to say that it seems like in those kind of premium cable shows, a lot of times that engine comes up at the very end of the pilot, and like in a network show, like a network thriller or something, it kind of seems to like come at the very beginning, right? Like you're trying to like capture people and make sure they like come back after the commercial break. I guess you would do that on AMC also. I don't know. I guess I'm just trying to think like back on like when you're pitching a show, like what people like you are looking for in it to determine whether you think it's a show that people will care about.
Well, when you talk about an engine, I think a character engine is about an unsolvable conflict. And I think that that unsolvable conflict is what makes it a TV show and not a movie. Because a movie has a conflict that is solved in 2 hours.
Right. That's why I always talk about Walter White basically being the perfect engine. Every time he succeeds, he makes his problems worse.
Right. And I mean, but I think that it's like...
But isn't his problem solvable?
His problem was never getting the money.
Sure.
It's about having an insolvable conflict like with yourself, like internally and externally, I think is sort of the thing that you're looking for.
Is it in a feature you end up changed by the end, and in a TV show you don't end up changed by the end of the pilot?
I mean, well, definitely not by the end of the pilot. I mean, I think arguably you'd say by the end of the series maybe they would change. But sometimes no. I mean, look at the greatest characters there are. I mean, if you look at like Tony Soprano, like is he any different? Is Walter White any different at the end? He maybe is a little more self-aware. I mean, I think same for like Don Draper. I don't know that he's
better at the end.
Different. Yeah. I think he's more evolved. I think he's accepting himself in a way that I think so that actually, I mean, now that I think about it, I think that makes him very different than he is at the beginning of the series.
He kind of lets go, of like his. Yeah.
Did you guys ever watch Review? Have you seen Review, Carrie?
Oh, the Andy Daly show?
The Andy Daly show?
Not really, but I love Andy Daly.
You do yourself a favor and watch that show. It is incredible. But the series finale, he basically, his flaw is that he believes that the work that he does reviewing life experiences is so valuable that he's willing to sacrifice everything, like his marriage, you know, his health, everything, to do this work, and he is given the cleanest out ever at the end of the series and like just goes right back into it. Like it's incredible. So anyway, that just reminded me of that. You should watch Andy Daly's the best. I think it was already an unpaid endorsement once upon a time.
Yeah,
it's also pretty short. Anyway, let's go back a little bit actually, because so you said that you had worked in features for a while and then moved to AMC. Can you tell us a little bit about what specifically you're working on and doing in the last 7 years, basically? What does a development person do?
Well, I mean, AMC in particular does current and development together. So that means that I hear pitches, I read scripts, I look for books to option or podcasts or, speaking of, is this for sale?
There's a bidding war. My mom loves it, this podcast.
Yeah. My mom, I already told her about it and she will be listening. Okay. Hi, Mom.
Hi.
Oh, cool.
And she will also love that I talked about her. But anyway, yeah, so you could option articles, whatever, and meeting with writers and developing ideas with them. And then you work on the scripts with them and then you ultimately get them ready to be considered. And then you are a part of the conversation to decide what scripts you pick up to series. And then you help hire writers, you give notes on the scripts, you hire the directors, you hire oversee casting and all those things. And then
are you on set?
Just a little bit, just right at the beginning. And if everything's going well, then not that much after that. But if things are not going well, then sometimes there needs to be a reason for you to be around. But that's usually only if there's something that's not working.
And so when you said that AMC does both development and current at the same time, you mean that you are the executive soup to nuts for the entire series, basically?
Yes.
Which is unique, right?
No. I'd say most places are both. Some places, basically, there's a development executives that work on something all the way until the pilot is complete, and then they hand it off to a current executive who does it the rest of the life of the series. And that just, is because current is a very time-consuming job, so sometimes some networks have chosen to have those jobs be separate.
Mm-hmm. They also seem like very different type of jobs, right? Current is like about knowing this show and how it works, right? The new development seems to be more about like Like you need to be sold on a new show that you've never seen before and think that you can sell it to other people as opposed to a show that already exists, I guess. I don't know. It just seems like a different part of your brain that you're exercising, you know?
I think that shows that maybe aren't as... I could see what you're saying is if a show is like a procedural or there was like a certain formula to the way that the show was made. So, you know, getting in the ones that are going to go 8, 9, 10 seasons, I can like see what you're saying. But a show that's maybe has a little bit more, I don't know, every variation. Season is something special. I think it's hard. You do still develop those seasons. It's not, you don't, you're still kind of contributing creatively. And so the people that worked on it from the beginning, partially because of the relationship that you would have with the creatives involved, makes the everything go more smoothly, and also you have a better understanding of the material going forward, so you would stay with the show. It's the same.
Right.
It's a different.
I didn't mean that it wasn't creative. I meant that your new shows are like a gamble a little bit, and a show that's greenlit, you're all you care about is making this show good. Right.
Yeah, you're making that show good, but it's still a gamble because who knows if it's going to work. And then every season you do, it's like, who knows if it's going to continue to work. So,
well, and your point of like each season being something special, we're in a new era where it's not like you set up an NCIS and it's like, well, there's a dead body at the beginning of every episode or whatever. I assume. I don't know what NCIS is.
I don't know if there is a body on that one.
I have no idea. Law and Order. Yeah. I don't watch procedurals. But you get what I'm saying. Like, yeah. You know, everyone's at the bar at the beginning of Cheers. But now that things change and shift and evolve, and each season does have its own big bad and sometimes even different locations and all of that stuff, it's a different deal. Also, I remember Comedy Central, I think originally when I was there, they would hand off after the pilot. And then when Kent came in, they started doing it where like basically every executive was soup to nuts. So you would carry over. And I think from a talent perspective, people like it better too, because like now Carrie's the person that found our show. We worked with her together, and like when we get to keep making it with her rather than like you being like, well, good job, everyone. Now you're going to series. And then you have someone new who's more, they tend to be a little more like nuts and bolts, like a little more closer to a line producer, not literally, but like there was a different mentality, I think, to those people. I wouldn't be surprised if that shift is happening everywhere.
I think that's, I mean, it's just a question of like volume, like how much you can handle, like each person, the amount of hours in the day to be able to find new things and also work on the things you're currently working on.
So that's a great question then. In general, how many shows are people kind of like trying to juggle at any given time? How many shows can one person handle that are both on the air and then also developing out a slate? How does that work?
Every network is different. I think that we're probably a little bit more curated. I think that each person is probably working on 2 or 3 current shows and developing in different stages probably 25 projects.
Mm-hmm. Which is a lot.
Yeah,
that's a lot.
It is a lot. But some places maybe that are higher volume, I've heard of I don't work at any of those places, but I've heard of development executives being on like 10 shows or something like that, which is a lot of time. And then so you're not necessarily, you may not be focused on development as much as you are on like hearing a pitch that is fully baked and ready to go to series, like a couple scripts are written or, you know, whatever.
Right. It's further down the line.
Right.
That's interesting.
Okay. So I guess I'm thinking of your job as 3 different things. You have the kind of maintaining the shows that are being shot. You have listening to pitches for new shows, and then you have finding material, like you said, podcasts or articles. Or books. Like, how much time of your week are you spending on just like finding new things?
I mean, well, there's a lot of different executives at different levels. So like everybody's kind of doing the same thing. So it's a kind of an all hands on deck situation. So it's like my assistant might find an article, or we have different meetings during the week where we talk about somebody could have found a book and they're like, oh, you know, that would be great for this showrunner that we have an overall with, or that would be, you know, there's a lot of, it's collaborative. Mm-hmm. And I think the speculative piece of it is catch as catch can, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. It's like when it comes across, you like do what your best to, like you have different avenues. Like we have a book scout and he would like give us a list of new books that are out that we could read. Mm-hmm. But a lot of it is just, you know, sometimes it'll be submitted by agents and sometimes it'll be things that you just find through different, like it'll just come across, like, I mean, we optioned a podcast to be developed just based on something that I just was a fan of the podcast. And I was like, oh, we could do it. This as a series, and just cold emailed them. And it could be that, like, where it's just something that you're a fan of, or it could be something that's like, you know, it depends on like how many hours you have in the day. Some days it's easier than others.
It goes into the stack, basically.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So speaking of reading, like, how many spec scripts do you read per week?
Just new scripts? I mean, I think that maybe 5 probably new scripts. And then there's like the scripts for the episodes or the shows you're working on. There's the scripts for the development that you're trying to get made that add up. So you're probably reading maybe, and there's also samples for people for writing, like, you know, for a staffing job. So I think, and just new writers that you want to meet. So I think it probably adds up to probably like 20 scripts a week, maybe something like that.
Yeah. Right.
But it's not, and sometimes it's not that many. Right. I mean, it just depends.
Right. I guess I think like what's interesting is like if someone is like trying to get someone at AMC to read their script, like, no, you're competing with, for their time against these shows that already exist, new shows that they're already developing. Like, well, it's hard to get your spec script read.
Also, Gary's been at this for a while. Correct me if I'm wrong, but you're not the first person to read the script once it gets to your desk, right? Mm-hmm. Like, your assistant has vetted it, or like other people are
not all the time. It depends. I mean, like, everybody's kind of doing their own thing.
Sure.
So it's like, yes.
But it's coming from an agent or something. There's a few filters. It's not like someone's like, hey, Gary, read this, you know?
Yeah, it could. I mean, I've had it come from so many different ways, you know, like there's things like, there's a million ways to get things through to people. I mean, like, I could ask somebody to read something, like a junior executive to read something for me, and my assistant read something for me. Like, that definitely happens. Sometimes I just read it, you know, it just depends on if I'm interested in reading it or not.
Does it come the other way around, though, I guess is what I'm getting at. Like, that someone has read something and said, oh, Carrie, I think you need to read this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's
it's
a big
more
part of
that.
The job. Yeah. Right. Yeah. There's a lot of that. I mean, I think that that's, I mean, you work at a place long enough, you move up and then you become the person that the person comes to say,
right. Your assistant, it's a huge win for that person if they're like, you're going to like this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That's the recommend pretty much.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and I think anybody who wants to be a development executive, that's the kind of thing you want to be able to find. And that's like the real like high altitude training of a development executive is that you find something that nobody cares about and you say it's good and it like gets somewhere. You know what I mean? Because it's like that's your taste is kind of the only chip you have to play. And so if you can find something that's awesome and nobody told you it was awesome, like it's like you're like, oh man, we really should work with this guy Steven Soderbergh, he's the best.
Sure.
And you're like, thanks, thank God you were here.
Yeah.
I mean, like, if you weren't here to say that, I don't know what we would have done.
But I guess like the good example is like, right, someone reads like the Mr. Robot feature script and they're like, this could be a TV show.
Yeah.
Right. And then it is.
Oren teases me all the time about like there's so much lingo of like, you know, we went another direction or whatever. Like there's a politeness to Hollywood sometimes that I think is interesting.
The writing didn't resonate with me.
It didn't really spark for me or whatever people say.
Oh yeah, no, there's like, I feel like you could make a whole like list of development cliches. Like, let's put a pin in it.
Sure.
Or like, we're circle the wagons, you know, or I'm trying to think of a
what
good
does circle the wagons mean?
Well, you know, it's like when you go and you talk to everybody else and then come back. And then, like, circling wagons is just, like, discussing.
Yeah, like, we can't talk about this in front of you is what we're saying. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, we're going to go circle the wagons on whether or not we buy this show from
you. Or, like, let's take this offline.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, man.
I'll think of some more.
Flashback, yeah.
as over the course of the conversation.
Yeah.
But circle the wagons, like, it could come back positive, right?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's not bad. None of them are supposed to be bad. They're all supposed to be, like, neutral to, like, get out of a conversation.
Yeah.
Right. So earlier you said, you know, if it's a script that you really want to read, you'll just read it. Like, can you give us any insight into, like, what makes you really want to read a script? Is it a log line? Oh, and just a kind of related question is, like, do you ever receive a script with, like, a packet, like a visual, any sort of pitch deck or anything?
Sure. It doesn't, I'll be honest, it doesn't really mean anything. I think when people do it, it can be helpful if you're in person to show some images while you're kind of talking about what you want to do. But the most important thing is the script. And if you are nobody and nobody's ever heard of you, the fact that you are able to make a presentation with like great images from other movies is sort of not relevant. The only thing that's going to matter is the script.
Does it put a little bit of like a stank on it?
No.
No.
I don't think so.
But does it help sell a tone? Like, I mean, like, I don't know if Black Mirror or like Drive or there's some movies and things where like the way it's made kind of elevates it, you know, beyond the script.
Yeah, like, I think that it's all like you can't. It all goes back to the script. If you have a script, that is the effective thing. I think sometimes a good sizzle, like a edited reel, that can be compelling and really set a tone. Images are an icing on the cake, I guess, but it's not the cake. So it's like you can't, you know, and I guess it's not even, icing is maybe even too grand a word for it. I think it's sort of just like it's window dressing. It's not going to push you over the edge.
Right. Because I guess good writing would give you the tone. You'd get the tone from that.
Though I will say, as much as like a document that has images is not going to sell anything, I do think a document that has information about the season or what you want to say with the series or like what the intent is can be very helpful.
Oh, that's interesting.
So I think that that is actually something that I think does people can be, you know, can be really interesting, especially if you have a show that goes a lot of different places and you want to be able to say, here's what this is going to be. Because, you know, the pilot may just be the tip of the iceberg. So you want to give someone a taste of like where it's going. And you also, that's your opportunity to really sell in prose as opposed to just selling on the page in a screenplay. So I think it's that's much more compelling than images. And sure, you could have like a document that has some images in it. I'm not saying like, it's not going to be like, oh, this amateur, why this and this? Like, people do it all the time. I'm just saying it's like, never in my life have I been like, this script's okay, but man, the lookbook.
Boy.
Really,
I also like Blade Runner.
Yeah.
I guess I think, what's that? Oh, the OA. Do you remember that show?
Yeah.
Sure.
I feel like that's a show that probably came in with like a lookbook, you know, like.
Yeah. I mean.
No, they all do. I'm just saying it doesn't really. And I think it's like, look, if you have a director attached to your material and they come in, they should have a lookbook. They should be saying what they think it should look like. They should have a strong point of view about the tone and the look of the show.
And what 100%. What if it's a writer director? They should same thing.
Sure. If they're coming in to meet, sure. They don't have to. But I guess I'm just saying it also depends on like, it depends on the context.
Right. Right.
I think it's like if you are nobody and you're just trying to get somebody to care about your story and you send in an email from an agent, the script and the lookbook, I don't need to look at the lookbook. But if I read the script and I liked it enough to meet, then you can show me the lookbook. Because you're talking about the series and you're like, this is how I want it to feel. This is the thing, whatever. But it's like actually just sitting on the page, it's like the script is the gate. I'm not even going to, why even look at the lookbook if I don't, but a format document like, or a document that like has like a little bit of a window into what the series is, I would definitely look at because I want to know what the intent is of the creator, especially if it's something that like is again, just a window into where it's going to go. And if it's not as traditional, then you may like episode one of a certain show, like you don't even know where it could go. You know what I mean? So you want to kind of know that.
That's so interesting. What about like a proof of concept? Like if someone sent like a, we filmed like the cold open or a trailer or something.
Yeah, I mean, I think film can be really compelling if it's good. Do you know what I mean? Or it can be an issue if it's just okay. Mm-hmm. Like, I think it's like kind of like you don't want to send it unless you know it's an A+. Because then because there's it's
but
so much.
But that's also true for the script.
Sure.
Right.
That's but I mean, but it's much easier to sell a promise than a product. Mm-hmm. So like if you just have a script where anybody can picture how it's going to be, then that's one thing.
And who's going to be in it and how much it's going to cost.
So, but if you shoot something and it's awesome, sure. But you have to really be hard on yourself when you make something. And just because you made it doesn't mean people should see it. Like I think.
Yeah.
So it's like it's a difficult thing to decide, but I think it's just the truth. Like, I mean, I think that's like why agents and managers one of the reasons they have a job is because they're the ones that's supposed to have the hard conversation with the client and say, I think we should just send the script. And it's not against the person. It's just more like if you didn't have the resources that you would have if you actually like had the money to really make it the way you wanted, you know?
Right. It's so interesting because I feel like a lot of times, I mean, maybe I'm just giving bad advice, but I say that it's like really hard to get people to read your script. And sometimes, you know, like we get people send us scripts all the time. I mean, as like directors or even as like podcast hosts, they're like, hey, I worked on this project. Here's a script. And if I see like a 60-page PDF, like I'm probably never going to read it. But if they send it with like a short film or like a lookbook, I'll probably flip through it because it takes like 10 seconds, you know. Or I'll watch the short film, and if the first scene is horrible, I'll probably stop. But I'll give that more of a chance to grab my attention than sitting down and reading the script.
Sure, but you wouldn't buy it.
Right. Well, right. So we're talking about two different things. Because if you are trying to get an agent or a manager, having more content that shows the versatility of you as a filmmaker or a artist can be very helpful. But I'm just saying to you, as somebody who's going to buy a piece of material, it just doesn't matter if that thing is good.
The only material is the script.
Yeah.
Is what you're saying. That's it.
That's the most important thing. You can have the other stuff and can be helpful. I'm just saying it's just not really.
Like, right. I guess
the script isn't good. It's not good.
Yeah.
And again, maybe this is because you're kind of like in a higher level and people are vetting a lot of projects before you're seeing them. But
you'd be surprised.
But I guess I'm just saying.
That is actually when I quit, I was like, oh, well, I've read a lot of garbage, so I know I can do better than that.
I guess I'm just saying, like, if the log line is a little lackluster, like, can something other than just the script get you to read the script? I mean, obviously, if there's a list attachments or something, that probably helps.
I think that that's where the log line does come in. I think there's so many levels of like what we're talking about of how to get noticed or like at different places. So I think that like if I was a writer and I was just starting out and I was like, if I'm giving somebody advice who's like a new screenwriter, I would write a sample with a really crazy hook. And so that if someone said the log line to you, then you'd be like, what? And you'd actually read it. Basically, it's like writing.
Don't worry about it getting made or anything like that, right?
It's like a blacklist script.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Which are all kind of like, it's kind of become a, you know.
Yeah, right. Sure.
The log line is the
Is the that's script. Like, that's sort of where it's gone. I mean, I don't read them anymore, but I mean, before when I used to, that was a big thing. But I think it's like compelling when somebody says, oh, it's this, they give you this great hook. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And
can you tell us related to that, how important is it for like the first 5 pages to grab you or any of that stuff?
I think it's important. I mean, I think you need to show your voice like and come in. And I don't know that it doesn't mean that it has to be like big. It just has to have a point of view. It has to be strong in like what it's saying. And I think that like readability is really important, especially when you're trying to get noticed as a staff writer, like as a young writer, is sort of like if you read like a good writer's script, it's like a pleasure to read. And the way that they write the action description is a subliminal message for what the tone of the piece is. You know what I mean? Like they write it in a certain, they don't overwrite it. It's not too much action description, but what they do economically sends a message about the kind of show that it is and like what it, they're very like deliberate in what, how they're saying the way a character is doing a certain thing. Like that, I think that the best scripts do that. Mm-hmm. And those are the ones that are a pleasure to read. And I think the dialogue is important and sort of like the way that you hook someone in the same way that you would think about for a pilot, the way you'd hook someone in if you just watched the show. If you saw a really compelling teaser, you'd probably watch the whole episode. It's the same thing if you're reading it. I mean, but I'm not just going to stop reading after the first 5 pages. I'll give it a chance. I'm just saying like, it is helpful to think of a compelling teaser. But I think if you're just trying to get noticed, you're trying to get representation, if you're trying to get staffed when you're young, it is like, or just starting out, having a unique, weird sample can be very effective.
Right. It's helpful to front load things.
Yeah.
Right? Like be interesting, right?
She's also saying like loud, weird, in your face, like
fresh,
bigger than
and original. Like saying like, oh, I just made Breaking Bad, but it's with a woman is like not that interesting.
Right.
Right. As opposed to I built a time machine to go get Richard Nixon to do this thing, whatever. Yeah. Right.
But it could also be very specific to who you are as a person.
Right.
I think that's the other thing that's really important is that especially in television is if you write a extremely authentic story that somebody would read.
Can you give us an example?
I mean, it could just be like someone's like personal personal story, like not like, I mean, like, I think like if they grew up in a really specific environment that they wrote about, like if they wrote about their family, like we work with a lot of playwrights and a lot of people's plays are about their own personal life. And like there's a, you know, like there's writers that they just write it about their family and they like, and it just feels so real that you're like, this person has like an ear for dialogue, or they like, they're perceptive in this way where you feel like they're going to be like, because when you're making a writer's room, you're making like a baseball team. So that, I think that that can be, it's like a just, you're putting your stamp on like, this is the kind of writer that I am. This is how I sound. This is my style. You know what I mean? Like, I think that, that's kind of what you're coming in with at first. And that could be, I mean, it could be a lot of different things. If you're Shane Black or something, you're, that's a certain kind of writing that, but it's very, it's very bold. You like read the first five pages and you're like, I get this. I get who this guy is. But that's not the same way that like the script for Girls for like Lena Dunham, that was like very specific to her experience and like more authentic and like what she wanted to say. But it was like totally different kind of vibe, but they both are valid in their own way.
I feel like though, like at least Girls is still kind of like at this universal message, still relatable, even though it's like hyper specific to like her experience. Because I feel like a lot of times we get, even people send us like, we made a web series and it's like about some diverse group of people in some town that you've never seen that story, but you look at the plot and it's like pretty much the same kind of drama. Like, it doesn't feel fresh aside from the casting, you know?
Yeah.
Or the location.
I want to shift a little bit actually, or maybe follow up with something you were saying before, Carrie. You were saying like there's a handful of different things that we're talking about here, right? And you kind of focused in on like, if you're a brand new writer, how to get noticed, right? Are you looking for that for baby writers, or are you kind of like working with people who are a little bit more established?
I think it doesn't matter as long as the script's good. I mean, I think Lodge 49, which is a show that's on AMC, that's a short story writer. That's the first, I'm not positive, but I'm pretty sure it's one of the first pilots he had ever written, if not the first.
I guess what I'm really asking.
I don't want to. I'm sorry if
we give a lot of wrong facts on this podcast. Don't worry.
It didn't read like it was the first thing he ever wrote. It was very good. We made it.
What I'm getting at is, you were saying, okay, well, if you want to be, you know, if you want to get noticed first thing, if you're young, this is what you do. Have you noticed what are people doing after they've, you know, been a staff writer and they're coming in, or like, what's the difference between trying to get noticed first thing and maybe like having been around a little bit?
I think like what Matt is asking is like, how does Matt get
noticed? I'm not, but I'm saying like, you were saying, well, there's a couple different things. Well, we talked about one of those things. Let's talk about the other one.
I think that I know when it comes to staffing shows, I think what people really respond to is, again, having a strong point of view about the material that you want to, of the show you want to work on. And in some cases, a show that we have called The Terror, that's a, this second season takes place during a Japanese internment. And there's a writer, the staff writer had a PhD in Japanese folklore. And he had been a writer's assistant on a bunch of shows, but like,
he's like, this is my time.
No, he was, and also I will say that he had.
Thank God he got the job, huh?
He did. But I will say he also had really strong recommendations from showrunners that he had worked with that were like, this guy is the guy.
Yeah,
and like, so great. That helped him kind of.
I'm so glad he got that job.
Me too. He was great.
Good.
I think having a strong point of view about material and like being able to be versatile. Well, it just depends. I mean, I think that like you do have to be able to, being a writer on a staff, it's like, it is more like a job, you know what I mean? Because you have to deal with, you know, a community of like other writers, and there's politics and figuring out where your role is and those kinds of things. And then I think that getting that experience on staff, because the writer is in charge ultimately in television, being a good writer and being experienced together can be very valuable to you.
Right. So that's the next step, really, is what you're saying.
Yeah, it's
right.
Like getting that experience. And then I think also, because getting the experience makes you a better writer, but it also makes you a better producer, which is ultimately the job that you're going to have to do as a showrunner.
Right.
But in the case of something like Lodge 49, we had Jim Gavin, who created that show. and that he didn't have television experience, so he was paired with Peter Ocko, a showrunner, and they worked on the show together. Yeah.
Yeah,
it
makes sense.
I think, I mean, we've talked a ton about writing, but I guess the other thing that's really interesting is, like, how do you hire directors? Like, what do you look for in that?
Episodic directing, or for pilots or episodic?
Ooh, let's go both. Well, let's start with pilots, actually.
I mean, pilots, I think it's the same thing you'd look for in features. It's like you're looking for somebody with a point of view that they have, they're a storyteller, and they have a point of view of how to use the camera to help tell the story.
And how do you determine that? What are you looking at?
I mean, I think there's a lookbook. Here comes our lookbook. There is a lookbook.
I got some lookbooks. Yeah, for you, Carrie.
So, I mean, I think that, like, having a specific point of view and a take as to, like, how the show would look, I think is important. I think that there's more of a collaborative partnership for pilot directors. I mean, I think AMC is maybe more of a traditional TV network where we do that is a collaborative situation. I think maybe, again, in certain premium situations, sometimes the filmmaker is sort of taking over, or in some cases, but that's not necessarily true in the way that we've traditionally done it.
If you have, like, someone that's directed a lot of comedy stuff, but they have, like, a really great pitch on, like, a dramatic series, would you consider them? Like, how much is their previous work playing into?
I think it matters. I mean, it's more like, can they do it? Like, it's somebody like a guy like Hiro Murai doing Atlanta, technically, sure, that's a half hour, but, like, we would have give that guy any drama, you know what I mean? Because of the work that he's doing is so cinematic on a half hour that it kind of does translate. But somebody who's maybe done more traditional half hour work that has less cinema kind of associated with it and is more about the kind of comedic timing, mm-hmm, and the, you know, kind of like closed sets or whatever, like, that's going to be harder to give the person that opportunity.
So their past work has, like, a huge, it is probably a bigger indicator than even their pitch and their lookbook. And
yes, I mean, well, stuff. we probably wouldn't
meet with them.
Yeah, I mean, we wouldn't go out to them in the first place, and if that's the case, because we're looking for people that we feel like could make it happen.
Right.
Do you ever have, like, open directing assignments?
Not really, because we're kind of only doing, we're making so few, you know, we only make a certain amount of shows a year. And so, and usually the showrunner has a really strong opinion about the kind of director that they want. So they, you know, kind of dictate the process.
Let's take a step back, because how many directors do you even meet with on a pilot? Like three, give or take?
It depends. It can be more.
Yeah.
But, like,
I imagine if the three are great, then you stop there. But if they're not great, you'd keep going.
But no more than, say, 10, right?
No, yeah, right, definitely, yeah, not.
But obviously there's way more than 10 great directors that do hour-long, you know, shows, right? So how do you even get that list? Where does that get whittled down from? Tell us about that process a little bit before you get to the meeting stage.
I mean, I think it's just about working with the showrunner to determine the look of what they want the show to be. And then we put together a list of people that are available.
So when you say put together a list, because you've met with those people, because you're aware of their work, because agencies sent you the people they liked, all of the above.
Because they had a movie at Sundance that did well.
All the above.
So if you're a director that wants to be on Carrie's list, you have to be at an agency and have a movie at Sundance. I'm teasing, but I guess what I'm saying is like, this is the stuff that the show is about, right? Like,
yeah,
you go from everybody to less than 10 people. That in between is the question mark for me.
Well, I mean, I think it's like a lot of his availability, experience. I think that if it's a big show, you can't give it to somebody who hasn't done something that's that big before. Sure. Then people start getting nervous. You know what I mean? You need it to be somebody who has experience to a degree. But it's somebody, I think, that has it isn't an exact science. I think that that's the maddening thing about working in the entertainment business is, like, there's no map to how you get, and so much of it is exactly what you think. It's like timing and opportunity, and you never know how those things are going to come about.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I think we've had quite a few directors on that have directed pilots, and I feel like it's like a Sarah Dina Smith or... Augustine Frizzell. She did, like, an HBO pilot. She did one feature at Sundance, and it tonally just happened to hit the exact right thing they were looking for that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that if you're like the one, if you made one feature and it is exactly the vibe that you need for the pilot, yes, you could do it.
Sure.
But it's like, it just, you're kind of just, again, you just, it just, it's all opportunity, you know?
Right. But there's nothing like, I think everyone we've talked to, there's nothing like, not one of those people like a Paul Briganti or Matt Pollock or any of them like have like said like, I'm aiming for that list. They're all like, I'm going to make stuff. And hopefully, you know, if it resonates with people, hopefully they'll add me to their list.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, right. I think agents do suggest people, they know that what's available and they will suggest their clients for the material. Because, I mean, we can't know about everybody.
Of course, yeah. So the show gets picked up. You guys are going for it. Now you need a handful of directors. What happens then?
For
series.
For series, yeah. Episodic. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that that depends on the show. I think that if a show is big and complex and lots going on, more likely to work with or feel more comfortable with directors with more experience. I think shows that are smaller, more contained, then you have an opportunity to take more risks and try out new people. Mm-hmm. So that's, I mean,
more episodes too, right? You know, like I'm always season six of like a network sitcom. It's like, oh yeah, the line producer directed an episode on that one, you know.
Right. So it's like, yeah, again, a first season show, you're still figuring it out. And so you're booking people when you haven't shot a frame. Right. So you don't know how it's going yet.
Right.
So then you're like, you're sort of thinking like, we've made this huge investment. Mm-hmm. We want someone who's like a steady hand to do this, you know?
And also that line producer on season six probably knows that show better than most people in the world.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, and it's like, hey, I'm going to quit unless you give me an episode.
Yeah.
Maybe. We've seen a shift from multiple directors in a season to oftentimes like a show just having a single director throughout the entire time. Do you have any thoughts on that?
I think it's a post issue most of the time. Mm-hmm. I think that that's a exciting thing to have someone do all the episodes, but that means that you can't start editing it until after they're done shooting, which means that then your post schedule is like way longer because it's going way after the thing's done shooting. And so that can affect if your show is supposed to be on the air at a certain time, that pushes your air date and it also makes the post longer. So that's more expensive. So I think that.
Awesome. I'm sold on it. I want more directors on
series. Unless it's your show.
So I think can be, I think that's a luxury that I think more traditional television networks like don't really have.
Mm-hmm. But some cable networks I feel like are doing that more, right? Like I feel like FX will do that all the time and always drives me nuts, right? Like Baskets, isn't that one guy?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they'll figure out a way to do it. I mean, it happens.
Yeah.
I think that hour-long's harder.
Right. I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, that's cool. So the easiest way into TV is get a PhD in Japanese folklore.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny. I feel like I've run into a lot of people recently that have been like writing their whole lives, but then have shifted a little bit into screenwriting or entertainment later in their careers. Mm-hmm. And be like, oh, I was a novelist or a playwright or something like that. And then I think there is something seductive about discovering the new awesome voice, the exciting voice that hasn't been in television or film at all, but also with a lifetime of experience and craft, and like they're still storytellers, and
they're confident and command. They have a lot of command.
They're great at their job. They're just, it's a new form for them, and so it's like they get the best of both worlds, and I'm very jealous.
Yeah, I think you just.
I should go write a book.
Well, I mean, look, you're not wrong. I mean, that can be. It's always helpful to like have proven yourself in a different field.
Sure.
But there's also like a ton of lawyers that end up as writers.
Sure.
And they're good. You know what I mean? Like, I think that happens a lot.
Yeah. Just like be smart and like live life a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
And be, I feel like lawyers and writers are both like very detail oriented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, when you read a script, like you said, from someone that's not detail oriented, it's like annoying.
And you realize, wait, being a lawyer sucks. I need to do something else that's very lucrative.
Yeah.
But I feel like in conclusion, there's not to plug our podcast too much, but like it seems like kind of the way to success in TV as a filmmaker or a creative person outside of the studio is or outside of the company is you make stuff, stuff, either write stuff and show it to people and pitch it until it's good enough to get bought, or create, you know, make movies or whatever, shoot stuff until enough people notice it to put you on their list.
Oh my God, totally. I mean, I think the Just Shoot It concept is awesome. I mean, I know I was kind of like poo-pooing the like, you know, lookbook or whatever, but if you like, there's definitely writers. I mean, just recently there was a short that someone had made that was really great that my coworker had seen and showed to me and was like, we should staff this person on this room. Like, this short is awesome. Mm-hmm. And that's how she found it, was the short. And she like went and found who represented him and was like really into it. And like, just based on seeing the short, was just like, this is great. And like, this person's perfect for the show. And like that, I think that does totally work. I think that like the sort of presentation or trying to do the little bit of your total big idea that maybe you didn't have the money to really do the way you mm-hmm. wanted, then you get into trouble.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, I think, you know, if you could figure out a way to do it, like you look at like the short for like George Washington or whatever, mm-hmm. or like right. Boys in the Hood, that was started mm-hmm. as a short, or
like Whiplash.
Yeah. Whiplash. Like, you know, there's so many, if you can get the funding right. for it, you can really impress somebody and it can just like skyrocket
right.
like the, right. your opportunities. So I do think a good short is can really do something.
Help you out. Yeah.
But I have my own opinions about what makes a good short.
Sure.
Ooh. Can you just give us three bullet points real quick?
I think it's just the one piece of advice I would give is it needs to be a completed thought. You have to say something. You mm-hmm. have to complete the short and say, oh, okay, that's what you were saying. I think a lot of times it doesn't.
It's just fizzle out a little bit.
Yeah, fizzle out or just sort of don't say something that's like that profound. Like you're just kind of like shrug right. at the mm-hmm. end of it.
Or it's like a slice of life, right?
Yeah. Like it's like you want to say something. I think that can work. The slice of life can work if you really put the money into the look mm-hmm. and that's more what you're selling. But I know for me personally, I'm looking for somebody where I'm like, wow, like this is, you said something and this felt emotional. I think, well, like the Whiplash short, I saw that short because sure. my friend produced it and I was like, I remember like there was a screening at the Soho House or something and we like went and saw it. I like saw that and I like cried.
Yeah.
And I was just like, wow, this is like, it really just was like, and I think that was sort of a representation of like this person's ability to convey emotion in a scene. And it was, that's a big risk to take that like, because that is less a completed thought and more of it just like mm-hmm. just like a spear into your gut, and he nailed it.
What happens in the short? I've never seen it.
It's the scene.
Yeah, it's just the Not My Tempo scene, right?
Yeah.
Oh, that's a good scene.
Yeah. So I mean, I think that goes against my like my advice.
No, but it does give you it gives you an engine. It gives you point of view. It gives you obviously there's visual and it's musical. You know, and
it's more complete
fun
than
to watch way
than it. Could be like oftentimes it's like, oh, we just shot a scene from the movie mm-hmm. like, well, it doesn't feel like it's
yeah we went to this festival where Chrissy's movie played, remember, I forget what it was called, but there was this one short about this couple that lived in like Afghanistan or Iran or something. They were there was some civil war and they had to be like hiding out in their apartment and it was real. I mean, it was in Arabic and stuff and they were hiding and people were shooting and it looked good, it felt real, but that's all they did. They were just hiding out all night and I was like, where are we going with this? Like, I love the authenticity, but it's nothing. It's like, you know, them, a couple, and their couple issues hiding out while, you know, there's terrorists outside.
Yeah. Yeah. Again, just kind of slice life with, but without anything. The thing I wanted to go back to, though, the thing I love about the shorts in general, and kind of what I realize now I was getting at with the, like, what do you literally do when you make a list question, is I think that it always kind of boils down to access, mm-hmm. right? And so, you know, if you don't have an agent and you haven't met Carrie Gallocly in person, then you don't end up on that list, right? But the flip side of that is that I think there's a culture and development of being the first to find the cool new person, right? So seeing that short, like sending that around the office and being like, oh my God, this is so awesome. Let's meet this person. That's the way in. That's why Just Shooting It still makes sense.
Makes sense.
Whether you have an agent or whatever, you know what I mean? Like, just because you can't hand somebody a script or forward them an email or whatever, there's still a way to get in front of people like you.
Completely. I think it's the, I mean, it's the right thing to do if you want to, that's kind of the only thing you can do, especially writing. It's like easier to do. You can do it like, I mean, it's not easy. Don't get me wrong. Sure. It's really hard, but it's, you can just do it on your laptop.
You can go to the library and type.
Right. Yeah. But yeah. Directing, it's really like, that's such a huge, it takes a, it's a lot of, you know, confidence and courage and risk. Sure. That goes into really doing
naivete, maybe even.
No, I mean, well, I think that's certainly. That's a powerful thing. Yeah. And I think it takes a lot of guts to do it because you got to convince a ton of people to do it with you. So I think it's a completely valuable thing to do, and I like really respect it. And it's just, you know, and I think those things do matter, you know, and can get you representation and can get you in the right doors for sure. But you just have to, that's why I would say really think about what your short is.
Mm-hmm.
Like really be hard on yourself about what the concept for your short is. I'd say think really litigate, what is the idea that you're shooting? What are you trying to say? How good is the story? Mm-hmm. That's the thing you should be like really thinking about. Why is this my calling card? Like, why is this the thing that I want someone to send around people's offices and then shoot it?
Mm-hmm.
But like, really think about it before you do it, because it's like, if you're really going to put everything into that, you want to make sure that it's right.
And I'm 99% sure I know the answer to this question, but if a short has like 10 million views or something, does that make any difference to you?
Not really. I mean, I think it's like, I mean, sure, I guess. I mean, like if it's like popular, sort of. I guess I just don't think about it like that.
No,
I don't think it matters.
The answer is no.
I don't think it matters.
Curious being nice. No. Yeah.
I mean,
it's just, is it good?
I mean, that's the sad thing is that like doesn't really mean anything anymore, because it's like if something has a lot of views, like so do a lot of
right.
Just well, kind like, of like whatever things. Videos.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which again is great news, right? Like you wouldn't hold it against a Vimeo link that had 200 views.
No.
20 views. You don't
not
care
if it's good.
Yeah,
who cares?
You don't care.
If anything, you're like, yeah, nobody's heard of this yet.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
Like, in the contrary. Yeah. Like if something has 5 million views, but the production values, like it's clearly viral because it's about something hyper specific, like a Harry Potter thing or something, you know, but it's not, I guess, I think a lot of times.
Your rap video about Harry Potter.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter.
I have it pretty good. Straight out of Hogwarts.
I actually would love
have you ever seen that?
About Harry Potter.
Yeah, Gary would love that.
I have one. It's got about 2 million views.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, Carrie. We could talk for another 5 hours, but I think we should probably hop into endorsements.
Let's do it. Unpaid endorsements.
Unpaid endorsements. Charles is the person who sings our unpaid endorsements theme.
Really?
Yeah.
It's so funny because I know my unpaid endorsement is Light the Fuse. Light the Fuse, the Mission Impossible podcast that is hosted by two of our friends, Charles and Drew. The reason why I love it so much is that they really know what they're talking about.
Without
and
a doubt.
They get, and they really care, and but they're also like huge fans and they like love it so much.
Yeah.
And so, and they're also really funny. And so I think that's why the interviews that they do are so good, because the questions they ask are so specific, but they have through the lens of someone who's like a big fan of the mm-hmm. the stuff, and they're not really concerned about impressing the person. They're more just concerned with like, the kind of things a fan would ask, but like an extremely informed fan, because they both, you know, love movies, but also work in the business. And so it's like, I find the interviews to be like really compelling. And like, I also think they've gotten some really great people and continue to get great people.
I think that's why how they get those great people is like, it's not just a fanboy podcast. It's like, oh no, these guys know exactly what they're talking about. Oftentimes, like on the Elsbeth interview, like they definitely remembered things way more than he did.
Oh, no, but it was great. But and he was such, what a great interview. Robert
so
Elsbeth.
So good. Yeah.
Great.
What's
great.
The podcast about?
It's about Mission Impossible. It's about all of the
100%
Mission Impossible. And it's about all the movies, and they do all these different things. But they've kind of started, the domino effect has begun. So it's getting better and better because they got, you know, like the composer
from one
of the movies, and then
editor,
and then they ended up getting Chris McQuarrie, and then they got Robert Elswit, and then they have some more that I don't want to spoil. They have some good ones coming down the pike that I heard about, like Can't Put It Stand on Mike, but like I'm pretty excited about it. But the thing is I feel like so many movie podcasts, the people are so, they're trying to impress the person they're interviewing, or they're trying to sound smart in this way that is just distracting and annoying. And I think that, or they're just not funny or entertaining mm-hmm. as an interviewer. And like, look, I'm biased because I'm friends with them, but I think that they're like, really good interviewers, like to the point where when I was coming over here thinking about what I was going to say in this thing, I was like, they should do all of this and then they should pick another movie series and do it with something else that they love, like do another like deep dive. They should like make a deep dive podcast, because it's like I'm like loving every minute of it. It's great.
It's tricky though, because you know, you have to, I think part of what's beautiful about that podcast is that like it started when they were kind of nascently becoming, falling in love with film. Do you know what I mean? So like that first Mission movie came out in 96, 97. So I think like there's something beautiful about it tracking basically from adolescence into adulthood. Do you know what I mean? That would be hard to replicate.
Yeah. No, I guess I just like want them to do more.
Sure. Yeah. They have stretched 7 movies and a TV series into 40, 50 episodes of a podcast.
It's a lot.
Have they seen the whole TV show, series and everything?
Yeah.
They know everything about it.
They do. They do. They also have one that's all about like the movies that never got made, like that, like Oliver Stone was attached to direct Mission Impossible 2 at one point. So there's lots of like really good, like they like quote a lot of like Entertainment Weekly articles from like 1994. It's like pretty good.
But just off the cuff, like they've truly internalized it in a way that's very charming.
Yeah.
And I think they both have that head for data like that, you know, in a way that's impressive. Yeah. Light the fuse. Good one.
Yeah, sorry.
It's okay. I'm happy to talk about it. I've got 2, actually. 1 regular one and then a bonus one that, Oren, I think you're going to be excited about. So my first one is a music video that I have watched, I don't know how many, like 5 or 6 times. It's super simple, for a song called Fading by Abel Farben and Ilaria. I don't know. I don't know how to say their names. The links will be in the show notes. They're like a DJ and pop act. I don't like listen to their music at all. But I have a friend who was in the video, so I checked it out because it was like going super viral. And it's basically just your standard kind of like medium budget music video of like cool outfits and like a few models on like a pink psych, like in some fun props and they're posing. But then the twist is that this guy, my friend Dave, is this like incredible dancer who kind of just looks like a normal goofy kind of guy. He's got like a gnarly goatee and he's like a little heavy, and he keeps trying to sneak into the video and just does silly dances, and it's the cleanest stupid music video, and it is so charming to me. And so they end up in this weird, he and the pop star have this crazy duel where they're just kind of dancing and he's trying to like steal the spotlight. So simple, so elegant. I've watched it like 5 or 6 times in a row. It's like so funny and truly performance based on both ends. Like Dave is so incredible at like kind of stealing the spotlight, and the singer is like really good at kind of being annoyed with him without overselling it. So I thought, what a wonderful little music video. So we'll have links to the show notes. Maybe you guys have probably heard of this very famous person who I can't pronounce their name of. But the more important one, one of my favorite podcasts, Imaginary Worlds, and there's an important new episode called The Power of the Makeover Mage, and it is guest hosted by our one and only Jay McAuliffe, our editor.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It was like such a delight. I was like literally like freaking out.
Just by coincidence?
Just by coincidence. So it's one of my favorite shows, and Jay has been cutting the show for a couple years now.
Cutting our show,
and she does a great episode. So Imaginary Worlds in general is just about like geek and nerd culture. It's kind of like the best conversation and deep dive on like the minutia of fantasy worlds, basically. And they do a really interesting episode about the nature of video games and identity, basically. And like Jay and a number of other people kind of experimenting with their own identities in building an avatar, basically. It was really awesome. So way to go, Jay. Thanks.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, just real quick, my favorite podcast by far over the last like 2 months is the New York Times, The Daily podcast. It comes out every single day, every single work day. I guess I took President's Day off. But it's hosted by this guy named Michael Barbaro, and it's literally what happened yesterday in America. And it's just like the best. It's like New York Times level reporting. And it's just so good. It's like produced like any NPR podcast would be. There's like music and editing and all that stuff. But they like I don't know if you remember like a week and a half ago, like Donald Trump sat down with the publisher of the New York Times And they were like, the Daily is like who like kind of put that like report together. And it, I don't know, every single day it's like fascinating. They'll talk about the border. They'll talk about the one I heard today was about like the Democratic Party, how there is splitting on Israel, you know, like, I don't know. It's just so good and it's so in depth and it seems like pretty balanced to me, but I'm kind of biased. But anyway, Daily, it's my favorite podcast. And then another thing, just like a weird tip that probably most people know, but we were, I was shooting at Venice Boardwalk this past week and we wanted to do shots of people riding their bikes. And we didn't really have a good way to like move the camera with them and, you know, kind of conservative budget. And we only had a couple hours, but we rented like a pedicab. Do you know what that is?
Sure.
Like the bicycle guy that tows like a place that two people can sit. And it was like an amazing camera car for like a non-street.
That's really funny. That's really good.
So I'll post some photos. But
that's awesome.
It was just like, I was like, oh, this, I don't know why we don't use these pedicabs all the time. I mean, there is like some stamina required from the person that's pulling the pedicab.
You and some Anton Bauer powered.
Yeah. And also monitors. Uphill, like you feel the pedals, like great. The movement isn't through. But yeah, pedicabs as camera cars. Pretty
good. Pretty awesome. Cool.
Well, Carrie, how can our listeners keep track of what you're doing and find out more about you?
Oh, do we really want that?
That's kind of a weird way I phrased it, I suppose.
I mean, do you tweet?
I am technically on Twitter. I tweet occasionally, very rarely, like I'd say like 3 times a year.
Perfect.
But I'm there at Only Globally.
Perfect. Okay, we'll have all of that stuff up. Normally people have like, my reel is on my website sort of stuff.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, you can follow me on Twitter. and then forget that you followed me, and then 3 times a year you're like, oh,
she's got a new show coming out. Cool.
Like, oh. Well, I want to personally apologize to everyone listening that I wasn't like more interesting. I don't know. No, I just thought it seemed mean.
No, you get the hard truth. The hard truth is important, though.
And it's real. I promise I'm nice.
All right. Well, if you want to find out more hard truths, you can follow the show on justshootitpod.com or on SoundCloud, Stitcher. You probably already know all of that stuff. But social media, justshootitpod, Instagram, all of that. And Instagram is getting a little bit better, which is fine. Check it out, everybody. You can follow me at Mr. Madamo.
And I'm at Smitey Pileg. This episode was produced by Madeline Rosewatt. It was edited by Jay McAuliffe. And our webmaster is Ewan Williams. The music you are listening to right now is by the artist Jazar from the Free Music Archive.
That's all she wrote. I think that's it.
Rate us on iTunes if you don't mind.
Patreon.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.